nice. Uwe didn't know how to do it. Perhaps it was the way he'd been raised. Maybe men of his generation had never been sufficiently prepared for a world where everyone spoke about doing things even though it no longer seemed worth doing them. Nowadays people stood outside their newly refurbished houses and boasted as if they'd built them with their own bare hands, even though they hadn't so much as lifted a screwdriver. And they weren't even trying to pretend that it was any other way. They boasted about it. Apparently there was no longer any value in being able to lay your own floorboards or refurbish a room with rising damp or change the winter tires. And if you could just go and buy everything, what was the value of it? What was the value of a man? Her friends couldn't see why she woke up every morning and voluntarily decided to share the whole day with him. He couldn't either. He built her a bookshelf, and she filled it with books by people who wrote page after page about their feelings. Uwe understood things he could see and touch. Cement, and concrete, glass, and steel. Tools, things one could figure out. He understood right angles and clear instruction manuals, assembly models and drawings, things one could draw on paper. He was a man of black and white, and she was colour, all the colour he had. The only thing he had ever loved until he saw her was numbers. He had no other particular memory of his youth. He was not bullied, and he wasn't a bully. Not good at sport, and not bad either. He was never at the heart of things, and never on the outside. He was the sort of person who was just there. Nor did he remember so very much about his growing up. He had never been the sort of man who went around remembering things unless there was a need for it. He remembered that he was quite happy, and that for a few years afterwards he wasn't. That was about it. And he remembered the sums, the numbers, filling his head. Remembered how he longed for their mathematics lessons at school. Maybe for the others they were a sufferance, but not for him. He didn't know why, and didn't speculate about it either. He'd never understood the need to go round stewing on why things turned out the way they did. You are what you are, and you do what you do, and that was good enough for Uwe. He was 7 years old when his mum called it a day one early August morning. She worked at a chemicals plant. In those days people didn't know much about air safety, Uwe realized later. She smoked as well, all the time. That's Uwe's clearest memory of her. How she sat in the kitchen window of the little house where they lived outside town, with that billowing cloud around her, watching the sky every Saturday morning. And how sometimes she sang in her hoarse voice, and Uwe used to sit under the window with his mathematics book in his lap. And he remembered that he liked listening to her. He remembers that. Of course her voice was hoarse, and the odd note was more discordant than one would have liked, but he remembers that he liked it anyway. Uwe's father worked for the railways. The palms of his hands looked like someone had carved into leather with knives, and the wrinkles in his face were so deep that when he exerted himself the sweat was channeled through them down to his chest. His hair was thin and his body slender, but the muscles on his arms were so sharp that they seemed cut out of rock. Once, when Uwe was very young, he was allowed to go with his parents to a big party with his dad's mates from the rail company. After his father had put away a couple of bottles of Pilsner, some of the other guests challenged him to an arm wrestling competition. Uwe had never seen the like of these giants straddling the bench opposite him. Some of them looked like they weighed 200 kilos. His father wore down every one of them. When they went home that night, he put his arm round Uwe's shoulders and said, "Uwe, only a swine thinks size and strength are the same thing. Remember that." And Uwe never forgot it. His father never raised his fists, not to Uwe or anyone else. Uwe had classmates who came to school with black eyes or bruises from a belt buckle after a thrashing, but never Uwe. "We don't fight in this family," his father used to state, "not with each other or anyone else." He was well liked down at the railway, quiet but kind. There were some who said he was too kind. Uwe remembers how as a child he could never understand how this could be something bad. Then Mum died, and Dad grew even quieter. as if she took away with her the few words he possessed. So Uwe and his father never talked excessively, but they liked each other's company. They sat in silence on either side of the kitchen table and had ways of keeping busy. Every other day they put out food for a family of birds living in a rotting tree at the back of the house. It was important, Uwe understood, that it had to be every other day. He didn't know why, but it just didn't matter. In the evenings they had sausages and potatoes. Then they played cards. They never had much, but they always had enough. His father's only remaining words were about engines. Apparently his mother was content to leave these behind. He could spend any amount of time talking about them. "Engines give you what you deserve," he used to explain. "If you treat them with respect, they'll give you freedom. If you behave like an ass, they'll take it from you." For a long time he did not own a car of his own, but in the 1940s and 50s, when the bosses and directors at the railway started buying their own vehicles, a rumour soon spread in the office that the quiet man working on the track was a person well worth knowing. Uwe's father had never finished school and didn't understand much about the sums in Uwe's schoolbooks, but he understood engines. When the daughter of the director was getting married and the wedding car broke down rather than ceremoniously transporting the bride to the church, Uwe's father was sent for. He came cycling with a toolbox on his shoulder so heavy that it took two men to lift it when he got off the bicycle. Whatever the problem was when he arrived, it was no longer a problem when he cycled back. The director's wife invited him to the wedding reception, but he told her that it was probably not the done thing to sit with elegant people when one was the sort of man whose forearms were so stained with oil that it seemed a natural part of his pigmentation. But he'd gladly accept a bag of bread and meat for the lad at home, he said. Uwe had just turned 8. When his father laid out the supper that evening, Uwe felt like he was at a royal banquet. A few months later, the director sent for Uwe's father again. In the parking area outside the office stood an extremely old and, worse for wear, Saab 92. It was the first motor car Saab had ever manufactured, although it had not been in production since the significantly upgraded Saab 93 had come onto the market. Uwe's dad recognized it very well. Front-wheel driven and a side-mounted engine that sounded like a coffee percolator. It had been in an accident, the director explained, sticking his thumbs into his braces under his jacket. The bottle green body was badly dented, and the condition of what lay under the bonnet was certainly not pretty. But he produced a little screwdriver from the pocket of his dirty overalls, and after lengthily inspecting the car, he gave the verdict that with a bit of time and care and the proper tools, he'd be able to put it back into working order. "Whose is it?" he wondered aloud, as he straightened up and wiped the oil from his fingers with a rag. "It belonged to a relative of mine," said the director, digging out a key from his suit trousers and pressing it into his palm. "And now, it's yours." With a pat on his shoulder, the director returned to the office. Uwe's father stayed where he was in the courtyard, trying to catch his breath. That evening he had to explain everything over and over again to his goggle-eyed son and show all there was to know about this magical monster now parked in their garden. He sat in the driver's seat half the night with the boy on his lap, explaining how all the mechanical parts were connected. He could account for every screw, every little tube. Uwe had never seen a man as proud as his father was that night. He was 8 years old and decided that night he would never drive any car but a Saab. Whenever he had a Saturday off, Uwe's father brought him out into the yard, opened the bonnet and taught him all the names of the various parts and what they did. On Sundays, they went to church. Not because either of them had any excessive zeal for God, but because Uwe's mum had always been insistent about it. They sat at the back, each of them staring at a patch on the floor until it was over. And in all honesty, they spent more time missing Uwe's mum than thinking about God. It was her time, so to speak, even though she was no longer there. Afterwards, they'd take a long drive in the countryside with the Saab. It was Uwe's favourite part of the week. That year, to stop him rattling around the house on his own, he also started going with his father to work at the railway yard after school. It was filthy work and badly paid, But, as his father used to mutter, it's an honest job and that's worth something. Uwe liked all the men at the railway yard, except Tom. Tom was a tall, noisy man with fists as big as flatbed trucks and eyes that always seemed to be looking for some defenseless animal to kick around. When Uwe was 9 years old, his dad sent him to help Tom clean out a broken-down railway car. With sudden jubilation, Tom snatched up a briefcase left by some harassed passenger. It had fallen from the luggage rack and distributed its contents over the floor. Before long, Tom was darting about on all fours, scrabbling together everything he could see. "Finders keepers," he spat at Uwe. Something in his eyes made Uwe feel as if there were insects crawling under his skin. As Uwe turned to go, he stumbled over a wallet. It was made of such soft leather that it felt like cotton against his rough fingertips. And it didn't have a rubber band round it like Dad's old wallet to keep it from falling to bits. It had a little silver button that made a click when you opened it. There was more than 6,000 crowns inside, a fortune to anyone in those days. Tom caught sight of it and tried to tear it out of Uwe's hands. Overwhelmed by an instinctive defiance, the boy resisted. He saw how shocked Tom was at this, and out of the corner of his eye, he had time to see the huge man clenching his fist. Uwe knew he'd never be able to get away, so he closed his eyes, held on to the wallet as hard as he could, and waited for the blow. But the next thing either of them knew, Uwe's father was standing between them. Tom's furious, hateful eyes met his for an instant, but Uwe's father stood where he stood. And at last Tom lowered his fist and took a watchful step back. "Finders keepers, it's always been like that," he growled, pointing at the wallet. "That's up to the person who finds it," said Uwe's father without looking away. Tom's eyes had turned black, but he retreated another step, still clutching the briefcase in his hands. Tom had worked many years at the railway, but Uwe had never heard any of his father's colleagues say one good word about Tom. He was dishonest and malicious, that was what they said, after a couple of bottles of Pilsner at their parties. But he'd never heard it from his dad. "Four children and a sick wife," was all he used to say to his workmates, looking each of them in the eye. "Better men than Tom could have ended up worse for it." And then his workmates usually changed the subject. His father pointed to the wallet in Uwe's hand. "You decide," he said. Uwe determinedly fixed his gaze into the ground, feeling Tom's eyes burning holes into the top of his head. Then he said in a low but unwavering voice that the lost property office would seem to be the best place to leave it. His father nodded without a word, and then took Uwe's hand as they walked back for almost half an hour along the track without a word passing between them. Uwe heard Tom shouting behind them, his voice filled with cold fury. Uwe never forgot it. The woman at the desk at the lost property office could hardly believe her eyes when they put the wallet on the counter.
"And it was just lying there on the floor? You didn't find a bag or anything?" she asked.
Uwe gave his dad a searching look, but he just stood there in silence, so Uwe did the same. The woman behind the counter seemed satisfied enough with the answer.
"Not many people have ever handed in this much money," she said, smiling at Uwe.
"Many people don't have any decency either," said his father in a clipped voice, and took Uwe's hand. They turned round and went back to work. A few hundred metres down the track, Uwe cleared his throat, summoned some courage, and asked why his father had not mentioned the briefcase that Tom had found.
"We're not the sort of people who tell tales about what others do," he answered.
Uwe nodded. They walked in silence.
"I thought about keeping the money,"
Uwe whispered at long last, and took his father's hand in a firmer grip, as if he was afraid of letting go.
"I know," said his father,
and squeezed his hand a little harder.
"But I knew you would hand it in, and I knew a person like Tom wouldn't," said Uwe.
His father nodded, and not another word was said about it. Had Uwe been the sort of man who contemplated how and when one became the sort of man one was, he might have said this was the day he learned that right has to be right. But he wasn't one to dwell on things like that. He contented himself with remembering that on this day he'd decided to be as little unlike his father as possible. He'd only just turned 16 when his father died, a hurtling carriage on the track. Uwe was left with not much more than a Saab, a ramshackle house a few miles out of town, and a dented old wristwatch. He was never able to properly explain what happened to him that day, but he stopped being happy. He wasn't happy for several years after that. At the funeral, the vicar wanted to talk to him about foster homes, but he found out soon enough that Uwe had not been brought up to accept charity. At the same time, Uwe made it clear to the vicar that there was no need to reserve a place for him in the pews at Sunday service for the foreseeable future. Not because Uwe did not believe in God, he explained to the vicar, but because, in his view, this God seemed to be a bit of a bloody swine. The next day he went down to the wages office at the railway and handed back the wages for the rest of the month. The ladies at the office didn't understand, so Uwe had to impatiently explain that his father had died on the 16th and obviously wouldn't be able to come in and work for the remaining 14 days of that month. And because he got his wages in advance, Uwe had come to pay back the balance. Hesitantly, the ladies asked him to sit down and wait. After 15 minutes or so, the director came out and looked at the curious 16-year-old sitting on a wooden chair in the corridor, with his dead father's wage packet in his hand. The director knew very well who this boy was, and after he convinced himself that there was no way of persuading him to keep the money, he felt he had no right to, the director saw no alternative but to propose to Uwe that he should work for the rest of the month and earn his right to it. Uwe thought this seemed a reasonable offer, and notified his school that he'd be absent for the next 2 weeks. He never went back. He worked for the railways for 5 years. Then one morning he boarded a train and saw her for the first time. That was the first time he laughed since his father's death, and life was never again the same. People said Uwe saw the world in black and white, but she was colour, all the colour he had. Chapter 6. A Man Called Uwe and a Bicycle That Should Have Been Left Where Bicycles Are Left. Uwe just wants to die in peace. Is that really too much to ask? Uwe doesn't think so. Fair enough, he should have arranged it 6 months ago, straight after her funeral. But you couldn't bloody carry on like that, he decided at the time. He had his job to take care of. How would it look if people stopped coming to work all over the place because they'd killed themselves? Uwe's wife died on a Friday, was buried on Sunday, and then Uwe went to work on Monday, because that's how one handles things. And then 6 months went by, and out of the blue the managers came in on the Monday and said they hadn't wanted to deal with it on Friday because they didn't want to ruin his weekend. And on the Tuesday he stood there, oiling his kitchen worktops. So he's prepared everything. He's paid the undertakers and agreed his place in the churchyard next to her. He's called the lawyers and written a letter with clear instructions and put it in an envelope with all his important receipts and the deeds of the house and the service history of the Saab. He's put this envelope in the inside pocket of his jacket. He's paid all the bills, he has no loans and no debts, so no one will have to clear up anything after him. He's even washed up his coffee cup and cancel the newspaper subscription. He is ready. And all he wants is to die in peace, he thinks, as he sits in the Saab and looks out of the open garage door. If he can just avoid his neighbours, he may even be able to get away by this afternoon. He sees the heavily overweight young man from next door slouching past the garage door in the parking area. Not that Uwe dislikes fat people, certainly not. People can look any way they like. He has just never been able to understand them. Can't fathom how they do it. How much can one person eat? How does one manage to turn oneself into a twin-sized person? It must take a certain determination, he reflects. The young man notices him and waves cheerfully. Uwe gives him a curt nod. The young man stands there waving, setting his fat breasts into motion under his t-shirt. Uwe often says that this is the only man he knows who could attack a bowl of crisps from all directions at once, but whenever he makes this comment, Uwe's wife protests and tells him one shouldn't say things like that. Or rather, she used to. Used to. Uwe's wife liked the overweight young man. After his mother passed away, she would go over once a week with a lunchbox. "So he gets something home-cooked now and then," she used to say. Uwe noticed that they never got the containers back, adding that maybe the young man hadn't noticed the difference between the box and the food inside it, at which point Uwe's wife would tell him that was enough. And then it was enough. Uwe waits until the lunchbox eater has gone before he gets out of the Saab. He tugs at the handle 3 times, closes the garage door behind him, tugs at the door handle 3 times, walks up the little footpath between the houses, stops outside the bicycle shed. There's a woman's bicycle leaning up against the wall. Again, right under the sign clearly explaining that cycles should not be left in this precise spot. Uwe picks it up. The front tire is punctured. He unlocks the shed and places the bicycle tidily at the end of the row. He locks the door and has just tugged at it 3 times when he hears a late pubescent voice jabbering in his ear.
"Whoa! What the hell are you doing?"
Uwe turns round and finds himself eye to eye with a whelp standing a few yards away. "Putting a bike away in the bike shed. You can't do that." On closer inspection, he may be 18 or so, Uwe suspects. More of a stripling than a whelp, in other words, if one wants to be pedantic about it.
"Yes, I can."
"But I'm repairing it,"
the youth bursts out, his voice rising into falsetto.
"But it's a lady's bike," protests Uwe.
"Yeah, so what?"
"It can hardly be yours, then,"
Uwe states condescendingly. The youth groans, rolling his eyes. Uwe puts his hands into his pockets, as if this is the end of the matter. There's a guarded silence. The lad looks at Uwe as if he finds Uwe unnecessarily thick. In return, Uwe looks at the creature before him, as if it were nothing but a waste of oxygen. Behind the youth, Uwe notices there's another youth, even slimmer than the first one, and with black stuff all round his eyes. The second youth tugs carefully at the first's jacket and murmurs something about not causing trouble. His comrade kicks rebelliously at the snow, as if it were the snow's fault. "It's my girlfriend's bike," he mumbles at last. He says it with more resignation than indignation. His training shoes are too big and his jeans too small, Uwe notes. His tracksuit jacket is pulled over his chin to protect him against the cold. His emaciated, bum-fluffed face is covered in blackheads, and his hair looks as if someone saved him from drowning in a barrel by pulling him up by his locks.
"Where does she live, then?"
With profound exertion, as if he's been shot with a tranquilizer dart, the creature points with his whole arm towards the house at the far end of Uwe's street, where those communists who pushed through the garbage sorting reform live with their daughters. Uwe nods cautiously.
"She can pick it up in the bike shed, then," says Uwe, tapping melodramatically at the sign prohibiting bicycles from being left in the area,
before turning round and heading back towards his house.
"Grumpy old bastard," the youth yells behind him.
"Shh," utters his soot-eyed companion. Uwe doesn't answer. He walks past the sign clearly prohibiting motor vehicles from entering the residential area, the one which the pregnant foreigner apparently could not read, even though Uwe knows very well that it's quite impossible not to see it. He should know, because he's the one who put it there. Dissatisfied, he walks down the little footpath between the houses, stamping his feet so that anyone who saw him would think he was trying to flatten the tarmac. As if it wasn't bad enough with all the nutters already living in the street, he thinks. As if the whole area was not already being converted into some bloody speed bump in evolutionary progress. The Audi poser and the blonde weed almost opposite Uwe's house, and at the far end of the row, that communist family with their teenage daughters and their red hair and their shorts over their trousers, their faces like mirror-image raccoons. Well, most likely they're on holiday in Thailand at this precise moment, but anyway. In the house next to Uwe lives the 25-year-old, who's almost a quarter tonner, with his long feminine hair and strange T-shirts. He lived with his mother until she died of some illness a year or so ago. Apparently his name is Jimmy, Uwe's wife has told him. Uwe doesn't know what work Jimmy does. Most likely something criminal, unless he tests bacon for a living. In the house at the other end live Rune and his wife. Uwe wouldn't exactly call Rune his enemy, or rather he would. Everything that went to pot in the residence association began with Rune. He and his wife Anita moved into the area on the same day that Uwe and Sonja moved in. At that time, Rune used to drive a Volvo, but later he bought a BMW. You just couldn't reason with a person who behaved like that. It was Rune who pushed through the coup d'etat that saw Uwe deposed as chairman of the association. And just look at the state of the place now. Higher electricity bills and bicycles that aren't put away in the bike shed and people reversing with trailers in the residential area in spite of signs clearly stating that it's prohibited. Uwe has long warned about these awful things, but no one has listened. Since then, he never showed his face in any meeting of the Residents Association. His mouth makes a movement as if it's just about to spit every time he mentally enunciates the words Residents Association, as if they were a gross indecency. He's 15 meters from his broken postbox when he sees Blonde Weed. At first he can't comprehend what she's doing at all. She's swaying about on her heels on the footpath, gesturing hysterically at the facade of Uwe's house. That little barking thing, more of a mutt than a proper dog, which has been pissing on Uwe's paving stones, is running round her feet. Weed yells something so violently that her sunglasses slip down over the tip of her nose. Mutt barks even louder. So the old girl has finally lost her faculties, Uwe thinks, standing warily a few meters behind her. Only then does he realize that she's actually not gesticulating at the house. She's throwing stones. And it isn't the house she's throwing them at. It's the cat. It sits squeezed into the far corner behind Uwe's shed. It has little flecks of blood in its coat, or what's left of its coat. Mutt bares its teeth. The cat hisses back.
Don't you hiss it, Prince,
wails Weed, picking up another stone from Uwe's flowerbed and hurling it at the cat. The cat jumps out of the way. The stone hits the windowsill. She picks up another stone and prepares to throw it. Uwe takes two quick steps forward and stands so close behind her that she can most likely feel his breath. If you throw that stone into my property, I'll throw you into your garden. She spins round. Their eyes meet. Uwe has both hands in his pockets. She waves her fists in front of him, as if trying to swat two flies the size of microwave ovens. Uwe doesn't concede as much as a facial movement.
That disgusting thing scratched Prince, she manages to say, her eyes wild with fury.
Uwe peers down at Mutt. It growls at him. Then he looks at the cat, sitting humiliated and bleeding, but with its head defiantly raised, outside his house. It's bleeding, so it seems to have ended in a draw, says Uwe.
Like hell, I'll kill that piece of shit.
No, you won't, says Uwe, coldly. His insane neighbour begins to look threatening.
It's probably full of disgusting diseases and rabies and all sorts of things.
Uwe looks at the cat, looks at the weed, nods. And so are you, most likely, but we don't throw stones at you because of it. Her lower lip starts trembling. She slides her sunglasses up over her eyes.
You watch yourself, she hisses.
Uwe nods, points at Mutt. Mutt tries to bite his leg, but Uwe stamps his foot down so hard that it backs off. That thing should be kept on a leash inside the residential area, says Uwe steadily. She tosses her dyed hair and snorts so hard that Uwe half expects a bit of snot to come flying out.
And what about that thing? She rages at the cat.
Never you bloody mind, Uwe answers. She looks at him in that particular way of people who feel both utterly superior and deeply insulted. Mutt bares its teeth in a silent growl.
You think you own this street or what, you bloody lunatic, she says.
Uwe calmly points at Mutt again. The next time that thing pisses on my paving, he says coolly, I'll electrify the stone.
Prince hasn't bloody pissed on your disgusting paving, she splutters and takes two steps forward with her fist raised.
Uwe doesn't move. She stops, looks as if she's hyperventilating. Then she seems to summon what highly negligible amount of common sense she has at her disposal. "Come on, Prince," she says, with a wave, then raises her index finger at Uwe. "I'm going to tell Anders about this, and then you'll regret it."
"Tell your Anders from me that he should stop stretching his groin outside my window."
"Crazy old muppet," she spits out, and heads off towards the parking area.
"And his car's rubbish, you can tell him that," Uwe adds for good measure.
She makes a gesture at him that he hasn't seen before, although he can guess what it means. Then she and her wretched little dog make off towards Anders's house. Uwe turns off by his shed, sees the wet splashes of piss on the paving by the corner of the flowerbed. If he hadn't been busy with more important things this afternoon, he would have gone off to make a doormat of that mutt right away. But he has other things to occupy him. He goes to his tool shed, gets out his hammer action drill, and his box of drill bits. When he comes out again, the cat is sitting there looking at him.
"You can clear off now," says Uwe.
It doesn't move. Uwe shakes his head resignedly.
"Hey, I'm not your friend."
The cat stays where it is. Uwe throws out his arms.
"Christ, you bloody cat. Me backing you up when that stupid bag threw stones at you only means I dislike you less than that weedy nutter across the street. And that's not much of an achievement. You should be absolutely clear about that."
The cat seems to give this some careful thought. Uwe points at the footpath.
"Clear off."
Not at all concerned by this, the cat licks its blood-stained fur. It looks at Uwe as if this has been a round of negotiation and is considering a proposal. Then slowly gets up and pads off, disappearing round the corner of the shed. Uwe doesn't even look at it. He goes right into his house and slams the door. Because it's enough now. Now, Uwe is going to die. Chapter 7. A man called Uwe drills a hole for a hook. Uwe has put on his best trousers and his going-out shirt. Carefully, he covers the floor with a protective sheet of plastic, as if protecting a valuable work of art. Not that the floor is particularly new, although he did sand it less than 2 years ago. He's fairly sure that you don't lose much blood when you hang yourself, and it isn't because of worries about the dust, or the drilling, or the marks when he kicks away the stool. In fact, he's glued some plastic pads to the bottom of its legs, so there shouldn't be any marks at all. No, the heavy-duty sheets of plastic that Uwe so carefully unfolds, covering the entire hall, living room, and a good part of the kitchen, are not for Uwe's own sake at all. He imagines there'll be a hell of a lot of running about in here, with eager, jumped-up estate agents trying to get into the house before the ambulance men have so much as got the corpse out. And those bastards are not coming in here, scratching up Uwe's floor with their shoes. Whether over Uwe's dead body or not, they had better be quite clear about that. He puts the stool in the middle of the floor. It's coated in at least 7 different layers of paint. Uwe's wife decided in principle that she'd let Uwe repaint one of the rooms in their house every 6 months, or to be more exact, she decided she wanted a different colour in one of the rooms once every 6 months. And when she said as much to Uwe, he told her that she might as well forget it. And then she called the decorator for an estimate. And then she told Uwe how much she was going to pay the decorator. And then Uwe went to fetch his painting stool. You miss the strangest things when you lose someone. Little things. Smiles. The way she turned round in her sleep. Even repainting a room for her. Uwe goes to get to his box of drill bits. These are single-handedly the most important things when drilling. Not the drill, but the bits. It's like having proper tyres on your car instead of messing about with ceramic brakes and nonsense like that. Anyone who knows anything knows that. Uwe positions himself in the middle of the room and sizes it up. Then, like a surgeon gazing down on his instruments, his eyes move searchingly over his drill bits. He selects one, slots it into the drill and tests the trigger a little so that the drill makes a growling sound. Shakes his head, decides that it doesn't feel at all right, and changes the drill bit. He repeats this 4 times before he's satisfied, then walks through the living room, swinging the drill from his hand like a big revolver. He stands in the middle of the floor, staring up at the ceiling. He has to measure this up before he gets started, he realizes, so that the hole is centered. The worst thing Uwe knows is when someone just drills a hole in the ceiling, hit and miss. He goes to fetch a tape measure. He measures from each of the four corners, twice to be on the safe side, and marks the center of the ceiling with a cross. Uwe steps down from the stool, walks round to make sure the protective plastic is in position as it should be, unlocks the door so they won't have to break it down when they come to get him. It's a good door. It'll last many more years. He puts on his suit jacket and checks that the envelope is in his inside pocket. Finally, he turns round the photo of his wife in the window so that it looks out towards the shed. He doesn't want to make her watch what he's about to do, but on the other hand, he daren't put the photograph face down either. Uwe's wife was always horribly ill-tempered if they ever ended up in some place without a view. She needed something to look at that's alive, she was always saying. So he points her towards the shed, whilst thinking to himself that maybe that cat annoyance would come by again. Uwe's wife liked cat annoyance. He fetches the drill, takes the hook, stands up on the stool, and starts drilling. The first time the doorbell goes, he assumes he's made a mistake and ignores the sound for that very reason. The second time he realizes that there's actually someone ringing the door, and he ignores it for that very reason. The third time, Uwe stops drilling and glares at the door, as if he may be able to convince whoever is standing outside to disappear by his mental powers alone. It doesn't work. The person in question obviously thinks the only rational explanation for his not opening the door the first time round was that he did not hear the doorbell. Uwe steps off the stool, strides across the plastic sheets through the living room and into the hall. Does it really have to be so difficult to kill yourself without constantly being disturbed? What? Fumes Uwe as he flings the door open. The lanky one only manages by a whisker to pull his big head back and avoid an impact with his face. Hi! The pregnant one exclaims cheerfully beside him, though a half meter lower down. Uwe looks down at her, then up at him. The lanky one is busy touching every part of his face with some reluctance, as if to check that every protuberance is still where it should be. This is for you, she says in a friendly sort of voice, and then shoves a blue plastic box into Uwe's arms. Uwe looks skeptical. Biscuits, she explains encouragingly. Uwe nods slowly, as if to confirm this. You've really dressed up, she smiles. Uwe nods again. And then they stand there, all three of them, waiting for someone to say something. In the end, she looks at the lanky one and shakes her head with resignation. Oh, please, will you stop fidgeting with your face, darling? She whispers and gives him a push in the side. The lanky one raises his eyes, meets her gaze and nods. Looks at Uwe. Uwe looks at the pregnant one. The lanky one points at the box and his face lights up. She's Iranian, you know. They bring food with them wherever they go. Uwe gives him a blank stare. The lanky one looks even more hesitant. You know, that's why I go so well with Iranians. They like to cook food and I like to... He begins with an over-the-top smile. Then he goes silent. Uwe looks spectacularly uninterested. Eat, the lanky one finishes. He looks as if he's about to make a drum roll in the air with his fingers. But then he looks at the pregnant foreign woman and decides that it would probably be a bad idea. And? He offers wearily. She stretches, puts her hands on her stomach. We just wanted to introduce ourselves, now that we're going to be neighbours. Uwe nods tersely and concisely. Okay, bye. He tries to close the door. She stops him with her arm. And then we wanted to thank you for reversing our trailer. That was very kind of you. Uwe grunts. Reluctantly, he keeps the door open. That's not something to thank me for. Yeah, it was really nice, she protests. No, I mean, it shouldn't be something to thank me for, because a grown man should be able to reverse with a trailer, he replies, casting a somewhat unimpressed gaze on the lanky one, who looks at him as if unsure whether or not this is an insult. Uwe decides not to help him out of his quandary. He backs away and tries to close the door again. My name is Parvana, she says, putting her foot across his threshold. Uwe stares at the foot, then at the face it's attached to, as if he's having difficulties understanding what she just did.
"I'm Patrick," says the lanky one.
Neither Uwe nor Parvana take the slightest notice of him. "Are you always this unfriendly?" Parvana wonders, with genuine curiosity. Uwe looks insulted.
"I'm not bloody unfriendly."
"You are a bit unfriendly."
"No, I'm not."
"No, no, no, your every word is a cuddle, it really is," she replies in a way that makes Uwe feel she doesn't mean it at all. He releases his grip on the door handle for a moment or two, inspects the box of biscuits in his hand.
"Right. Arabian biscuits? Worth having, are they?" he mutters.
"Persian," she corrects.
"What?"
"Persian, not Arabian. I'm from Iran, you know, where they speak Farsi," she explains.
"Farcical, that's the least you could say," Uwe agrees.
Her laughter catches him on the back foot, as if it's carbonated and someone has poured it too fast and it's bubbling over in all directions. It doesn't fit at all with the grey cement and right-angled garden paving stones. It's an untidy, mischievous laugh that refuses to go along with rules and prescriptions.
Uwe takes a step backwards. His foot sticks to some tape by the threshold.
As he tries to shake it off with some irritation, he tears up the corner of the plastic. When he tries to shake off both the tape and the plastic sheeting, he stumbles backwards and pulls up even more of it. Angrily, he regains his balance, remains there on the threshold trying to summon some calm, grabs hold of the door handle again, looks at the lanky one and tries to quickly change the subject.
"And what are you then?"
He shrugs his shoulders a little and smiles, slightly overwhelmed.
"I'm an IT consultant."
Uwe and Parvana shake their heads with such coordination they could be synchronized swimmers. For a moment it makes Uwe dislike her a little less, although he's very reluctant to admit it to himself. The lanky one seems unaware of all this. Instead, he looks with curiosity at the hammer action drill, which Uwe is holding in a firm grip, like a guerrilla fighter with an AK-47 in his hand. Once the lanky one has finished perusing it, he leans forward and peers into Uwe's house.
"What are you doing?"
Uwe looks at him as one does at a person who has just said, "What are you doing?" to a man standing with a hammer action drill in his hand.
"I'm drilling," he replies, scathingly.
Parvana looks at the lanky one and rolls her eyes, and if it hadn't been for her belly, which testified to a willingness on her part to contribute to the survival of the lanky one's genetic makeup, Uwe might have found her almost sympathetic at this point.
"Oh,"
says the lanky one, with a nod. Then he leans forward and peers in at the living room floor, neatly covered in the protective sheet of plastic. He lights up and looks at Uwe with a grin.
"Almost looks like you're about to murder someone."
Uwe peruses him in silence. The lanky one clears his throat a little more reluctant.
"I mean, it's like an episode of Dexter," he says with a much less confident grin. "It's a TV series about a guy who murders people."
He trails off, then starts poking the toe of his shoe into the gaps between the paving stones outside Uwe's front door. Uwe shakes his head. It's unclear to whom the lanky one was primarily aiming what he just said.
"I have some things to get on with," he says curtly to
Parvana and takes a firm grip on the door handle. Parvana gives the lanky one a purposeful jab in the side with her elbow. The lanky one looks as if he's trying to drum up some courage. He glances at Parvana and looks at Uwe with an expression of someone expecting the whole world to start firing rubber bands at him.
"Well, the thing is, we actually came because I could do with borrowing a few things."
Uwe raises his eyebrows.
"What things?"
The lanky one clears his throat.
"A ladder and an Eileen key."
"You mean an Allen key?" Parvana nods. The lanky one looks puzzled.
"It's an Eileen key, isn't it?"
"Allen key," Parvana and Uwe correct at the same time. Parvana nods eagerly at him and points triumphantly at Uwe.
"He said that's what it's called."
The lanky one mumbles something inaudible.
"And you're just like, woo, it's an Eileen key," Parvana jeers.
He looks slightly crestfallen.
"I never sounded like that."
"You did so," did not. Yes, you did.
I didn't.
Uwe's gaze travels from one to the other like a large dog watching two mice interfering with its sleep.
You did,
said one of them. That's what you think, the other one says.
Everyone says it.
The majority is not always right. Shall we Google it or what?
Sure, Google it.
Wikipedia it.
Give me your phone.
Use your own. Goo, I haven't got it with me, dipshit.
Sorry to hear that. Uwe looks at them as their pathetic argument drones on. They remind him of two malfunctioning radiators making high-pitched whines at each other.
Good God, he mutters.
Pavana starts imitating what Uwe assumes must be some kind of flying insect. She makes tiny whirring sounds with her lips to irritate her husband. It works quite effectively, both on the lanky one and Uwe. Uwe gives up. He goes into the hall, hangs up his suit jacket, puts down the hammer action drill, puts on his clogs and walks past them both towards the shed. He's pretty sure neither of them even notice him. He hears them still bickering as he starts reversing out with the ladder.
Go on, help him then, Patrick,
Pavana bursts out when she catches sight of him. The lanky one takes a few steps towards him, with fumbling movements. Uwe keeps his eyes on him, as if watching a blind man at the wheel of a crowded city bus. And only after that does Uwe realize that in his absence his property has been invaded by yet another person. Runa's wife, Anita, from further down the street, is standing next to Pavana, blithely watching the spectacle. Uwe decides the only rational response must be to pretend that she's doing no such thing. He feels anything else would only encourage her. He hands the lanky one a cylindrical case with a set of neatly sorted Allen keys.
Oh, look how many there are, says the imbecile, thoughtfully, gazing into the case.
What size are you after? Asks Uwe.
The lanky one looks at him as people do when they lack the self-possession to say what they're thinking.
The usual size?
Uwe looks at him for a long, long time.
What are you using these things for?
He says at last.
To fix an IKEA wardrobe we took apart when we moved.
And then I forgot where I put the Eileen key, he explains, apparently without a trace of shame. Uwe looks at the ladder.
And this wardrobe's on the roof, is it?
The lanky one sniggers and shakes his head.
Oh, right, see what you mean. No, I need the ladder because the upstairs window is jammed, won't open.
He adds the last part as if Uwe would not otherwise be able to understand the implications of that word, jammed.
So now you're going to try to open it from the outside, Uwe wonders.
The lanky one nods and clumsily takes the ladder from him. Uwe looks as if he's about to say something else, but he seems to change his mind. He turns to Pavana.
And why exactly are you here?
Moral support, she twitters.
Uwe doesn't look entirely convinced, nor does the lanky one. Uwe's gaze wanders reluctantly back to Runa's wife. She's still there. It seems like years since he last saw her, or at least since he really looked at her.
She's gone ancient. People all seem to get ancient behind Uwe's back these days.
Yes, says Uwe.
Runa's wife smiles mildly and clasps her hands across her hips.
Uwe, you know I don't want to disturb you, but it's about the radiators in our house. We can't get any heat into them, she says carefully,
and smiles in turn at Uwe, the lanky one, and Pavana. Pavana and the lanky one smile back. Uwe looks at his dented wristwatch.
Does no one in this street have a job to go to any more? He wonders.
I'm a pensioner, says Runa's wife, almost apologetically.
I'm on maternity leave, says Pavana, patting her stomach proudly.
I'm an IT consultant, says the lanky one proudly.
Uwe and Pavana again indulge in a bit of synchronized head-shaking. Runa's wife makes another attempt.
I think it could be the radiators.
Have you bled them? Says Uwe.
She shakes her head and looks curious.
You think it could be because of that?
Uwe rolls his eyes.
Uwe!
Pavana roars at him at once, as if she's a reprimanding schoolmistress. Uwe glares at her. She glares back.
Stop being rude, she orders.
I told you, I'm not rude.
Her eyes are unwavering. He makes a little grunt, then goes back to standing in the doorway. He thinks it could sort of be enough now. All he wants is to die. Why can't these lunatics respect that? Pavana puts her hand encouragingly on Runa's wife's arm. I'm sure Uwe can help you with the radiators. That would be amazingly kind of you, Uwe, Runa's wife says at once, brightening. Uwe sticks his hands in his pockets, kicks at the loose plastic by the threshold. Can't your man sort out that sort of thing in his own house? Runa's wife shakes her head mournfully. No, Runa has been really ill lately, you see. They say it's Alzheimer's. He's in a wheelchair as well. It's been a bit uphill. Uwe nods with faint recognition, as if he has been reminded of something his wife told him 1,000 times, although he still managed to forget it all the time. Yeah, yeah, he says impatiently. You can go and breathe their radiators, can't you, Uwe? Says Pavana. Uwe glances at her as if considering a firm retort, but instead he just looks down at the ground. Or is that too much to ask? She continues, drilling him with her gaze and crossing her arms firmly across her stomach. Uwe shakes his head. You don't breathe radiators, you bleed them, Jesus. He looks up and gives them the once-over. Have you never bled a radiator before, or what? No, says Pavana, unmoved. Runa's wife looks at the lanky one a little anxiously. I haven't got a clue what they're talking about, he says, calmly to her. Runa's wife nods resignedly, looks at Uwe again. It would be really nice of you, Uwe, if it isn't too much of a bother. Uwe just stands there, staring down at the threshold. Maybe this could have been thought about before you organized a coup d'etat in the Residents' Association, he says quietly, his words punctuated by a series of discreet coughs. Before she what? Says Pavana. Runa's wife clears her throat. But, dear Uwe, there was never a coup d'etat. Was so, says Uwe grumpily. Runa's wife looks at Pavana with an embarrassed little smile. Well, you see, Runa and Uwe here haven't always got along so very well. Before Runa got ill, he was the head of the Residents' Association, and before that, Uwe was the head, and when Runa was voted in, there was something of a wrangle between Uwe and Runa, you could say. Uwe looks up and points a corrective index finger at her. A coup d'etat, that's what it was. Runa's wife nods at Pavana. Well, yes. Well, before the meeting, Runa counted votes about his suggestion that we should change the heating system for the houses, and Uwe thought, and what the hell does Runa know about heating systems, eh? Uwe exclaims heatedly, but immediately gets a look from Pavana that makes him reconsider and come to the conclusion that there's no need to complete his line of thought. Runa's wife nods. Maybe you're right, Uwe. But anyway, he's very sick now, so it doesn't really matter anymore. Her bottom lip trembles slightly. Then she regains her composure, straightens her neck with dignity, and clears her throat. The authorities have said they'll take him from me and put him in a home, she manages to say. Uwe puts his hands in his pockets again and determinedly backs away across his threshold. He's heard enough of this. In the meantime, the lanky one seems to have decided it's time to change the subject and lighten up the atmosphere. He points at the floor in Uwe's hall. What's that? Uwe turns to look at the bit of floor exposed by the loose plastic sheet. It looks as if you've got sort of tire marks on the floor. Do you cycle indoors or what? Says the lanky one. Pavana keeps her observant eyes on Uwe as he backs away another step, so he can impede the lanky one's view. It's nothing. But I can see it's... The lanky one begins confusedly. It was Uwe's wife, Sonia. She was... Runa's wife interrupts him in a friendly manner, but she only has time to get to the name Sonia, until Uwe, in turn, interrupts her and spins round with unbridled fury in his eyes. That'll do, now you shut up! All four of them fall silent. Equally shocked. Uwe's hands tremble as he steps back into his hall and slams the door. He hears Pavana's soft voice out there asking Runa's wife what all that was about. Then he hears Runa's wife fumbling nervously for words, and then exclaiming, "Oh, you know, I'd better go home. That thing about Uwe's wife, oh, forget it, old bats like me, we talk too much, you know." Uwe hears her strained laughter and then her little dragging footsteps disappearing as quickly as they can round the corner of his shed. A moment later, the pregnant one and the lanky one also leave. And all that's left is the silence of Uwe's hall. He sinks down on the stool, breathing heavily. His hands are still shaking as if he was standing waist-deep in ice-cold water. His chest thumps. It happens more and more these days. He has to sort of struggle for a mouthful of air, like a fish in an overturned bowl. His company doctor said it was chronic and that he mustn't work himself up. Easy for him to say. "Good to go home and have a rest now," said his bosses at work. "Now your heart is playing up and all." They called it early retirement, but they might as well have said what it was, liquidation. A third of a century in the same job, and that's what they reduced him to. Uwe is not sure how long he stays there, on the stool, sitting with the drill in his hand and his heart beating so hard that he feels the pulse inside his head. There's a photo on the wall beside the front door of Uwe and Sonja. It's almost 40 years old. That time they were in Spain, on a coach tour. She's suntanned, wearing a red dress, and looking so happy. Uwe is standing next to her, holding her hand. He sits there for what must be an hour, just staring at that photo. Of all the imaginable things he most misses about her, the thing he really wishes he could do again is hold her hand in his. She had a way of folding her index finger into his palm, hiding it inside. And he always felt that nothing in the world was impossible when she did that. Of all the things he could miss, that's what he misses most. Slowly he stands up, goes into the living room, up the steps of the ladder. And then once and for all he drills the hole and puts in the hook, then gets off the ladder and studies his work. He goes into the hall and puts on his suit jacket, feels in his pocket for the envelope. He's turned out all the lights, washed up his coffee mug, put up a hook in his living room. He's done. He takes down the rope from the clothes hanger in the hall. Gently, with the back of his hand, he caresses her coats one last time. Then he goes into the living room, ties a noose in the rope, threads it through the hook, climbs up on the stool, and puts his head in the noose. Kicks the stool away. Closes his eyes and feels the noose closing round his throat like the jaws of a large wild animal. Chapter 8. A man who was Uwe and a pair of his father's old footprints. She believed in destiny, that all the roads you walk in life, in one way or another, lead to what has been predetermined for you. Uwe, of course, just started muttering under his breath and got very busy fiddling about with a screw or something whenever she started going on like this. But he never disagreed with her. Maybe to her, destiny was something that was none of his business, but to him, destiny was someone. It's a strange thing becoming an orphan at 16, to lose your family long before you've had time to create your own to replace it. It's a very specific sort of loneliness. Uwe, conscientious and dutiful, completed his 2-week stint on the railways. And to his own surprise, he found that he liked it. There was a certain liberation in doing a job, grabbing hold of things with his own two hands and seeing the fruit of his efforts. Uwe hadn't ever disliked school, but he hadn't quite seen the point of it either. He liked mathematics and was 2 academic years ahead of his classmates. As for the other subjects, quite honestly, he was not so concerned about them. But this was something entirely different, something that suited him much better. When he clocked off from his last shift on the last day, he was downcast. Not only because he had to go back to school, but because it had only occurred to him now that he didn't know how to earn a living. Dad had been good in many ways, of course, but Uwe had to admit he hadn't left much of an estate except a run-down house, an old Saab, and a dented wristwatch. Arms from the church were out of the question. God should be bloody clear about that. Uwe said as much to himself while he stood there in the changing rooms, maybe as much for his own benefit as God's.
"If you really had to take both Mum and Dad, keep your bloody money," he yelled up at the ceiling.
Then he packed up his stuff and left. Whether God or anyone else was listening, he never found out. But when Uwe came out of the changing rooms, a man from the managing director's office was standing there waiting for him.
"Uwe?"
he asked.
Uwe nodded. "The director would like to express his thanks for doing such a good job over the past fortnight," the man said, short and to the point.
"Thanks," said Uwe as he started walking away. The man put his hand on Uwe's arm. Uwe stopped.
"The director was wondering whether you might have an interest in staying and carrying on doing a good job."
Uwe stood in silence, looking at the man, maybe mostly to check if this was some kind of joke. Then he slowly nodded. When he'd taken a few more steps, the man called out behind him,
"The director says you are just like your father."
Uwe didn't turn around, but his back was straighter as he walked off. And that's how he ended up in his father's old boots. He worked hard, never complained, and was never ill. The old boys on his shift found him a little on the quiet side and a little odd on top of that.